Coming to you live and recorded to your hard drive, it's the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, we're celebrating my 15th anniversary of leaving the Baltimore Orioles in Major League Baseball. That was 15 years ago, May 26th, 2000.
Oh my gosh, you're getting old, Paul.
Thank you.
I'm getting old too. In our bullpen session, we'll be shooting the bull about Paul's career with the Orioles, how it started, and how he would come to meet them. You know, I really got to read these before I start reading them out loud. Paul, thank you for writing that, but I'm not saying that out loud.
All right.
But how Paul and I came to meet and develop our relationship as mentor-mentee and then friends.
And today's Out of the Park interview is with two very special people to meet. Mr. Rodney Lane, who worked alongside of me on the ground crew for the majority of my 15-year career in Baltimore, and who would eventually become one of my two trusted assistants at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Also joining us will be Rob Doach, longtime tarp crew foreman for the Orioles, who I hired as a very young high schooler back in the early 90s and is still there today, running the tarp crew for his current boss, Orioles head groundskeeper Nicole McFadden. They'll have plenty of stories to tell about our 15 and a half years working together at the Orioles. We'll have all that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Almost didn't get all that in.
No, we did great. Hey, folks, how's it going today?
Hey, what a great day. It's pretty exciting. I get to talk to some of my old friends today, so I'm really fired up for the show.
I'm excited to hear from them again. I haven't, you know, seen Rodney since you were with the Orioles, and I was just a wee little mini groundskeeper.
Yeah, Rodney and I go way, way, way back. He started just a year after I did, and I started in 85, in January of 85 with the Orioles, and we hired Rodney on just before the season started in 1986. And if I recall, he was one of those what we call stadium rats who would hang around the ballpark. And, you know, you just get to the point where you get tired of kicking them on, just say, all right, you know what, just come and work on the ground crew.
Get a job.
Now, we might get a different version of that story when we talk to Rodney, but that's my memory isn't the greatest from that far back.
Yeah,
but
that's it's always risky having the employees come on and talk about what it was like to work for you.
Exactly. So, but yeah, it's, you know, that was an incredible ride, that 15 and a half years. And you know, as a kid, I always wanted to, ever since my dad took me to Wrigley Field, which really was my inspiration to want to become a major groundskeeper, and which was, you know, like 10 or 12 years old when I went there. And the first time I walked up through the vomitory into the seating bowl and saw the ballpark, and of course, and then at that time, all games were day games there, and you'd see the ivy waving in the wind and just a beautiful sunny day for a game. And my first thought was, God, I'd love to take care of a place like this. And
awesome.
So really, it goes way back to that time. And when I went into college, I actually originally went into college majoring in meteorology, but calculus tended to beat me down. And I changed my major over to turf. And from there, I had a great advisor while I was in turf school by the name of Dr. Jim Love, or as we call him, JR, or Dr. Love, and who unfortunately passed away just this past fall.
Oh.
And but he was a fabulous advisor for all the turf students. Tough, really tough on you, but you know, you years later you realized why he was that way, and he really was generally concerned about your future. So you know, through that through Dr. Love, I got an internship at the Brewers.
Let's move us on into the bullpen and start from the beginning. So you started with the Brewers.
With the Brewers, yeah.
And that was an internship, right?
That was an internship. And actually back then, you know, internships weren't like they were today, because there were very, very few turf students who were interested in working in ballparks or in sports turf. It was relatively new And so I went there. I only had a 2-week internship at Milwaukee at the time.
Oh, wow.
And but learned a lot in that 2 weeks. I saw quite a few things, a truck and tractor pull on the field. And you know, we worked some games and, you know, you learned quite a few things. And I did go back to work a Packers football game that fall, actually. So I did get a little bit more experience from back. But it was Harry Gill who gave me, who was the head groundskeeper for the Brewers at the time, who gave me the advice that, you know, when it's time for you to go search for your job, send out 2 resumes, one to the general manager and one to the groundskeeper. And so I, you know, a year later, I graduated from the UW, and being the naive Midwestern boy that I was, decided, okay, well, I'm going to narrow down my search to like 6 ball clubs. All in the north. I didn't want to take care of southern grasses. Didn't want to deal with the heat and humidity. Not a heat and humidity kind of guy, and I wanted to stay out of New York City. So I didn't. Send the resumes to New York City.
It's funny thinking about you not wanting to work in the heat and humidity, and then ending up where you ended up. It's like,
yeah. Well, how was I to know? I'd never been there.
Yeah, it's true.
So, but Baltimore was the most southern city that I sent a resume to, and so all the general manager sent, you know, letters back saying thanks, but no thanks. We'll keep your resume on file, you know, the old saying, and then it goes right in the garbage can.
I wonder if now, if a turf student were to send a resume to the general manager and to the head groundskeeper, if, I mean, that almost would come across as rude, wouldn't it? Sending it to the boss of the guy you want to work for.
I don't know about that.
Things were different then, but
normally what they do is they just forward it down to you.
Ah, okay.
But you know, and I even got that same letter from Hank Peters, who was the general manager at that time for the Orioles. He sent back a letter and said thanks, but no thanks. But then, like within a week after he sent that, I got a call from Pat Sanrone. And Pat said, "Hey, I'd like to talk to you about becoming my assistant here. I'm thinking of retiring in the future, and I'm looking for somebody to replace me." So he flew me out, and I got out there, and it was like the last homestand of the year. And I was only there. It was a quick 24-hour trip in and out of there, and no time at all. But the thing that amazed me at the time is I walked in and I met Pat, and we're sitting in his office, and I swear to God, there wasn't 2 minutes that had passed by that I had just met the man, and he said, "Well, if you want the job, you can have it." He never asked me any questions, and that bothered the hell out of me for 6 years. And when the year that Pat retired, and he retired on opening day 1991, that week before he retired, I had to ask him. I said, "Pat, how come you know when I came in here for my interview, you never asked me any questions of what I could do?" He had my resume. You know, I said, "But you offered me the job like within a couple minutes after I got there. You know, how did you know I was the guy?" And he said, "Well, you know, you had Harry Gill as one of your references." And so I called Harry up and I said, "Hey, Harry, what do you think of this guy?" And Harry said, "Well, he's your guy if you can get along with him." What the hell did that mean?
I know what he meant.
He said, "Well, no, it had nothing to do with you." He said Harry knew that I was a pain in the ass to get along with. Meaning Pat was the, you know, the Italian that he was. He was not easy to get along with sometimes.
No, it had nothing to do with you, Paul.
And he said, "You know, all I had to do was meet you." And he said, I realized right away that you were the guy I wanted. And so I offered it to you right away. And, you know, as I've gone on in the future and gone into this type of thing of having to do hiring, a lot of times, you know, you'll find that you can tell within 2 minutes if you're going to hire somebody or if you're going to hire or not hire somebody, mm-hmm. just by their personality and whether you're going to be able to get along with them.
Yeah.
And, but it was pretty interesting to me. I just didn't expect that to be offered the job 2 minutes after I walk in the darn office and just barely have met this person.
Oh, that's funny.
That was it. I picked up and moved lock, stock, and barrel to Baltimore the following January, and or actually it was February, middle of February. Mm. And off the career started at an old dumpy ballpark, which actually I grew to love very quickly. It was weird. To the first time I walked into that ballpark, my first reaction was I looked around. There was no shade over the upper deck, which I had never seen a ballpark like that before.
I forgot.
Memorial Stadium really wasn't a ballpark. It was really more of a football stadium that they also made into a ballpark.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was rather odd. But I grew to love that park. It was it was built actually the same time as County Stadium here in Milwaukee. But I thought it was in better shape than Milwaukee's was. But either way, both of them were dumps when you compare them to what we moved to afterwards.
Was that sand or that wasn't sand yet? That was
no, that
soil.
Was all native. That was all native soil, and we had tremendous issues, especially the last couple of years before we moved to Oriole Park. We had huge issues with Poa annua and Poa trivialis.
Oh, bet.
Where to the point where we had massive. Ugh. I mean, massive patches and all over the outfield, and we'd have, you know,
not
Baltimore
hiding that with
you
the mowing pattern
is incredibly hot and incredibly yep. humid, and you'd get the dieback of this stuff in the middle of summer, and ugh. We'd have these huge dead patches all over the field.
Oh my gosh!
And the city didn't want to spend money to resod the field for nope. the last couple of years that we were there, and the Orioles weren't going to do it, so we had to suffer through it. Mm. We tried killing the stuff one October with Roundup. We went through and sprayed every patch. And I'll be damned if the stuff didn't come back twice as vigorously, even though we had sprayed it, overseeded it with rye. I mean, it just
wow. took off.
But it was interesting because, you know, Pat was self-taught. He didn't have a lot of college training.
Right.
And here I come in, this young buck with all this, you know, piss and vinegar of all
we're
these
all
ideas.
We're all so
and,
fun our first couple of years
and,
out
you know,
of college,
and,
aren't
and
we?
Pat was doing so many things that were wrong, but, you know, that they worked for him at the time, you know, like we were yeah. when we got there, we were spraying Subdue, which was a Pythium control product back then, and
yep.
that was all he sprayed. We sprayed Subdue all the time, and I told Pat, I said, you know, Pat, we probably really ought to rotate chemicals because, you know, if we don't, we're going to get resistance. Well, he didn't want to do that. Sure yeah. enough, a couple years later, we developed resistance to Subdue, and we
no.
couldn't rid Pythium. And you know, so there were things like that. You know, he believed in fertilizing with straight urea, 3300, hot stuff. So we had the ups and downs of growth. You know,
wow.
you'd have the lush and growing like crazy for 2 weeks, and then you'd go downhill, and for 2 weeks you looked starving, and then we'd fertilize again and take off again. And I said, Pat, you know, we really ought to think about putting some slow release fertilizer down here. You know, let's just get a nice even keel going there. And
yeah, you can time it out with the non-slow release stuff, but you got to have that well timed. Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to you can't be putting down a pound at a time and then waiting 4 weeks. You have
yes.
to meter it out.
Meter it out every week or two.
But back
yeah.
then, keep in mind we're talking about the mid-80s.
Yep.
Things were way different back then, and what Pat wanted to see is heavy lush growth growing like crazy. So that's what it was. So lots of interesting little things that happened.
Well, let's get ready and get started to bring in our special guests and see what they have to say about you.
All right. That sounds good.
All right.
Well, you know, as we reminisce about my time in Baltimore, I want to let you in on a little Beacon history lesson. Did you know that the Streamliner chalkers that we developed and have sold for the past 14 years have their roots in the chalkers that you see at Oriole Park at Camden Yards? Yep. Those chalkers in Baltimore were purchased in the late 1970s, before my time there. And when we moved to Oriole Park from Old Memorial Stadium, I wanted to purchase new ones. And then I found out that the company that made those didn't exist anymore. So we rebuilt the existing chalkers at that time. Now, let's go forward to when I moved from Baltimore and came here to Beacon. Here in Wisconsin, my first priority then was to build a better chalker. So we had Al Capitas from the Orioles, who was the groundskeeper who replaced me, ship one of those chalkers out to us during the 2000 and 2001 offseason. Now, we put that in front of our engineer, Jim Merlin. He took a look at it, and I contributed some comments. And with that, we were able to come up with a lot of improvements and the development of the Streamliner chalker. And the rest, well, as they say, is history. The Streamliner comes in two-wheel or three-wheel 35-pound hopper models or a four-wheel 70-pound hopper model. Now, the Streamliner applies consistent and even chalk lines with the operator in full control of the thickness of chalk desired during the application. This innovation alone resulted in our customers cutting back by 30% or more in their chalk consumption, and that's a huge savings. We've sold thousands and thousands of these chalkers since their introduction to the industry back in 2001. You can easily say that the Streamliner chalker is the standard in the industry for dry line marking on sports fields. Order your Streamliner today online at our website at www.beaconathletics.com or give our experienced sales staff a call at 800-747-5985. If it wasn't for those old chalkers at the Orioles, we might not have developed the Streamliner chalker that you use today. As Paul Harvey used to say, and now you know the rest of the story. Good day. All right, and we are back, and I can't tell you how excited I am to talk to these two gentlemen that we have with us today. Mr. Rodney Lane, who worked with me for probably, I would say, 85-90% of my career in Baltimore. Rodney, and who eventually would become my assistant head groundskeeper once we moved to Oriole Park. And we also have Rob Doach with us today. Rob is a legend, in my opinion, in the tarp industry. I hired Rob at a very young age. What were you, Rob? 16?
17? I think I just turned 17 when you hired me.
17, yeah.
Wow.
And he's been there ever since. This is like 94, 93? No, 92. 93. 92? Okay.
June of 92.
June of 92, and he is still there today working under Nicole McFadden, the current head groundskeeper. So this guy has logged a lot of hours in the ballpark and knows his way around a tarp. So welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Good to hear from you.
Well, you can't see me, but you can hear me.
Well, I got a picture of you up here on my computer screen. Oh, yeah. Just so I have some frame of reference.
Is that pencil drawing? Well, I want to kind of go in chronological order here and go through some events that I remember, and feel free to throw in events that you guys remember as we start talking about. So, Rob, you might feel a little left out early on here, because I'm gonna go all the way back to right after I started working in Baltimore, and I worked the first year without Rodney around, and we had, you know, in those days that they weren't like the crews of today, where you have a lot of turf students on there. Because there were very few, if any, turf students who were interested in sports turf back in that time. I was a rarity, and because I was a turf, I had just graduated from turf school, and so the makeup of the crew was pretty much inner city kids, some not so trustworthy, and mm-hmm. Rodney knows what I'm talking about, and then eventually Rodney came on board. You came on board right away, the start of the second season I was there, right, in 86?
Yeah, I came on in March 24th of 86.
Damn, you remember the date. That's impressive.
Yeah, I remember that date.
Now, were you one of the stadium rats who hung around the stadium begging for a job all the time? I was trying to remember that in the early part of the show.
No, I actually found out about the job through another employee who used to work there. William Hunter and his brother Bruce was working there at the time. Me and him was working together.
Now that's
he told
not,
me what a great job it was.
But you know, I think there was a couple of tough situations at Memorial Stadium over the years that we dealt with, and I think the first one was probably that 0-21 start in 1988. I'm sure you remember that, Rodney, and you know, for all these people who cry about a losing streak. You don't know what a losing streak is until your team starts out 0-21 at the beginning of the season. And that's the way the Orioles started out. And I used to have a habit, you know, and I always used to do this to Rodney. Once we get past the halfway mark of the season, I used to start counting down the home games that we had left to work. And I'd say, Rodney, only 32 left. Only, you know, mm-hmm. And we just keep counting down. And he'd just look at me and laugh. And then when we had the 0-21 season at the start of the season, we started counting down at the end of April.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that bad. It was just
at one point, it was more of us sitting out there than the fans.
Yeah.
Isn't that like from Major League? Maybe that's why they decided to film at your park.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah. And then the other big event I remember from Old Memorial Stadium, well, there's two more, but the other one that I remember is, and I'm sure Rodney remembers this one. You remember the night that Pat left and didn't tell me whether to put the tarp on or not?
Oh, yes.
Oh, boy. That was my learning point in my career. Pat would never stay till the end of the game. He would typically leave an inning or two early. And usually you'd say, yeah. Paul, don't put the tarp on, or Paul, put the tarp on. Well, we were in the middle of a drought year, and Pat left without telling me where to put the tarp on it. There was a slight chance of showers in the forecast. This is back in the days before the internet, kids.
No radar.
We would have to call the weather service and say, so tell us what we should do.
Yeah.
So the guy at the weather service says, well, if we get anything tonight, it'll be a sprinkle. So I told the tarp girl, okay, guys, never mind. We're not going to put the tarp out. Go ahead and we'll see you tomorrow night. We had another game for the next night. So I start driving home and I pull into my driveway and it starts sprinkling. And I go, huh, this must be one of those sprinkles that's coming in. Get into the house. I start getting ready for bed. And I start laying in bed, and the rain starts picking up. And the next thing you know, it starts pouring.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm going, well, this will end any time now. That was at like 11 o'clock. 4:30 in the morning, it's still pouring. Has not stopped. It's been pouring all night. I never went to sleep that night, and I made myself sick to my stomach. I was spending much of the time in the bathroom. Mm. I was scared beyond belief. Having a nervous breakdown, and 4:30 came along, and I called the weather service, and the new forecast was out, and it was supposed to be a beautiful day originally, and they said, well, it looks like we're going to have rain till about noon, and then it should clear out after that. And I'm thinking to myself, I am in deep crap. Mm. So I start calling up all the tarp crew. It was the summertime, so they didn't have school, and I said, get in there as soon as possible. We get in there at 7 o'clock. And the dugouts are flooded to the top of the step. There's, you know, water's everywhere. The tarp's not on the field. It's raining. And I'm thinking, this is the end of my career right here. I'm done. About 9 o'clock, as usual, Pat strolls in. By this time, the rain stopped. So they were wrong on the forecast the second time, thank God. But it was still cloudy and low overcast. And, you know, weren't getting any drying conditions going. I'm trying to find every ounce of turfus in the whole city of Baltimore that I can get. We ended up throwing, I think, 3 or 4 tons of turf. We threw everything we had at that field.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, it'd be put it on, soak it up, take it off, put some more on and so forth. But Pat comes in and you know, Pat had told me tons of stories over the years of how he used to have to bring in helicopters and start fires on home plate to dry up the fielding. But for some reason his memory escaped him that day. And he comes in and starts lambasting me about not putting the tarp on. I can't believe you didn't put the tarp on last night. You know, I never did that ever in my career. I never had a field that was underwater. I'm thinking,
yeah,
you told me all these stories. And so we're sweating it. We're busting our tails that morning trying to get ready. The sun didn't come out till right about batting practice time, which we canceled. We were, you know, the problem was we could get the infield dirt dry, but the water kept draining off of the grass of the infield because of native soil field. It's not getting soaked in. It's just kind of running off. So the problem was the leading edge of the infield, it kept being soaked. So we called infield practice, and sure enough, for the game that night, you know, we got the field ready to go, and they played. And at the end of the night, Cal told me that was one of the best fields we ever had.
Yeah, he sure did. We just shook our head on that. We couldn't believe he said that.
Yeah, it was.
Soft.
And that was the last time we ever took a chance, wasn't it, Rodney?
Yeah.
If there was a chance,
that
it
was
went
a
on.
Long
it
day. Was,
it was just
that. That was a long day.
So
yeah,
from there,
that was the good old days.
Yeah, yeah. And then we moved downtown. And Rodney, what do you remember about building the ballpark? We were involved.
Say it again.
What do you recall about building the new field?
Well, I recall us picking up, because back then we didn't use big rolls to lay the field.
Yeah.
We used those individual rolls that you pick up.
Yeah, the small rolls.
Oh,
and that's
gosh.
How we laid the entire field that way. We also graded the field. I remember us working from sunup to sundown. I remember me and Gary and Paul kept looking back to the outfield saying, when are we going to get done? Remember when we laid the last piece and we all fell out on the track?
Yeah.
We laid the last piece aside. Seems like it's over.
I don't remember.
That was what I remember about that, because we did a lot of the grading.
Yep.
They did some of the grading. We did a lot of the grading, especially on the infield and the foul territory. And we also laid all of the sod, every piece of sod, yeah, all the way up to the bullpen. We laid it all.
Yeah, they had the guy who was building the field for us was an old school teacher, and I didn't really trust his construction skills. And
yeah, they were Southern turf, right?
Southern Turf Nurseries was the name of the company at the time. I don't know if they're still around or not, but they installed the initial field, and my guys were involved in all of it once we finished the season up at the old ballpark. And we finished up sodding late in November, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's right. And it was just before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah. And it, like you said, Rodney, this was before, Big Roll Sod was coming around. It was just in the process of being invented at the time of laying Big Roll Sod. So we were one of the last ballparks that really did that. A lot of the newer ballparks right after us started using the Big Roll Sod in the installation purposes. So I wouldn't want to do that again.
Nah.
So we opened up the new ballpark, and in comes Rob. And, you know, we used to hire tarp crew kids. You know, I used to go after high school kids that were, you know, and the reason we went after high school kids for tarp crew was because, you know, they had no life. They had no job, no other job. They typically didn't have a girlfriend. So they really had no place to go until they got on the ground crew or onto the tarp crew. And, you know, the thing I used to tell them in the interviews was, you know, the toughest part about this job is boredom, fighting boredom. And they would all say, oh, I don't mind sitting around all day. And, you know, typically after about 3 weekends of coming in and sitting there all day long with nothing to do, waiting for the ground crew to say, hey, we need you on the tarp. That ended really quick.
Oh, I love baseball. I never want to work in baseball again.
And Rob, how the heck you've done it all these years and stayed around there.
Yeah.
What is it, Rob, that has kept you there for how many years now?
Well, let's see, 92, so this would be my 23rd season. I don't know. I stopped keeping straight. You know, after I reached 20, I'm like, I really don't have to count anymore. I've been here a long time, so let that suffice.
You're at the point of lifetime benefits, right, from the Orioles?
Yeah, sure, right, yeah. I don't know what's kept me there all this time. I got there and we started working and kind of established myself, and the team was getting, you know, when we got there in 92, the team wasn't all that great. And we started getting better and better, and we got into the 96 and 97 seasons and did really well. I said, man, I really need to see, I'd like to see, you know, if I could just see a World Series game played here. Yeah. I don't care if we win it or lose it or anything. I would just like to see that happen on this field, and then I'll be done. That'll be the end of it. And we almost got there in 97, and then the dark ages hit. And I don't know, there was just always something that kept me around. I love the place. I mean, that's my place. So when I walk in there, it's feel like I walk into my living room.
And that's probably the case. If any of you ever get a chance to go down and see the tarp crew room down at Oriole Park, Rob has created all kinds of shrines. He's got all kinds of records.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the most valuable tarp. What is MVTC or something
we
like
do,
that?
I do every year. I started keeping stats on what guys do on the crew, and I started doing that during the seasons in 96. And every year, you know, we wind up with somebody's got, you know, the best spot on the crew. He's done the most work and has showed up the most, and they're the crew champ. And then I usually have, you know, a rookie of the year, whoever the new guy is that I've hired that has the best numbers, that's my rookie of the year. And we have a little ceremony usually for them at the end of the season during the end of the year parties. That's now like, you know, team-wide. They do the entire event staff has a shindig usually at one of the local venues for that. And, I've got that. I have my, you know, we started a Hall of Fame, Tarp Crew Hall of Fame, when Al was there. So just had a lot of great guys that I worked with, you know, and I said, you know, when they leave here, there's nothing left, and I wanted to, I said, it'd be nice just to have some people's names up on the wall, you know, if they've been here a long time and were good workers, you know, let's have something like that. So we put that together.
What was, and I'll ask each of you this question, what was your most memorable time, Rodney, back in those days? Of all the things that happened, what is it that you remember that was your favorite moment?
I got so many of them. I mean, one of one of the favorite moments was just us all together on the field at one time doing a project.
Yeah.
And working hard and ragging on each other, yeah. going from one person to the other person. And it yeah. went on all day.
And you're
and
right.
Everybody had a good time, and it didn't even feel like you were at work, but you were at work.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing I always remember is the camaraderie we had with the ground crew and the top crew when you guys came in. And you know, why not the year that we thought for the first time that we was actually going to make the playoffs? You know, we were sitting there celebrating. You had introduced us to the bratwurst. Never had those before. They were good, too. They were everything you said they were.
Oh, how Wisconsin.
And we never had those. And that year and the first year we went to the playoffs, I never thought that stadium could get that loud. I never seen yeah. it that loud. Cal Ripken's 21-30, Eddie Murray's 500th home run. There's just so many moments there. I can't even count it up
It is hard, yeah. But to go back to your part about working together with the crew, that is my fondest memories. The best times I ever had working out there was always when all seven of us would be working on a project like leveling the infield. This was back in the day before laser grading. We would mm-hmm. hand level the infield using string lines and stuff, and I still prefer that method, to be honest with you. But when we would work together, that, you know, a ground crew is like a family. You know, you're forced to live together for long hours, day after day after day, and you become very close. And you bide the time of hardworking days or weeks or whatever by playing off each other. And it was that fun. And I was equally as much of a target as I was an instigator. Wouldn't you agree, Rodney?
Yeah.
I mean, we were all equals.
Yeah, we were careful with you, though, because we knew you could really get us back. So we had to pick and choose. Had to pick our spots with Paul. Because he knew he could get us back better than anybody.
But, you know, one of the things that I did was I liked working alongside my crew. First of all, because I felt like if they had to be doing the work, then I should be there with them. And that was part of gaining respect of the crew, to know that, you know, I have their backs and hopefully they've got mine. And that I think that worked out very well for us while I was there. But the camaraderie was very special. And to this day, a lot of those guys I still feel very fond of and very close to, and get a chance to talk to them. And I like to go back pretty frequently. You know, I try to get back once a year to be able to see as many as I can. So, Rob, what about you? What are some of your fondest memories?
Well, if you're going to just talk like baseball related with the team, I would definitely have to say that during your tenure while you were there at the 21-31, when Cal Ripken broke Gehrig's record, that's definitely, I'd have to say, the top baseball moment that I had there. That was just that was a day that I would like to live over again a couple times. That was just a really, really magical time down there. And then just on a crew related, this kind of brings up an interesting story. Hey, Rodney.
Yeah.
Rod, you there? You remember that time that somebody came up and stole that Cushman?
Oh, this will be good.
Oh my God.
Yeah, dude. It's all coming back to me now.
Let me refresh your memory, Rodney. Actually, it was a Toro Workman, but what had happened in this is actually the epitome or the best of all of our practical jokes that we used to play on each other. So I was coming in late one day from work. I had to take our car in to drop off for service, and my wife dropped me off in front of the Oriole offices. And I noticed our workman was sitting out in front, which meant somebody was going to get the mail for the clubhouse. So I thought, oh, I'm going to hop on this thing and take it. So I grabbed it. I took off, hoping that the person wouldn't walk out and see who grabbed it. And I drove it down underneath the stadium into where the ground crew was. And I pulled up, and there was George standing there. I said, George, hurry up and hide this workman somewhere. So we pulled out the batting cage, hid it back behind the batting cage, and put the batting cage back in its place. And I get into my office, and I get all comfortable and act like I've been there a little while. And Rodney comes walking down from up in the warehouse, and he goes, where's the truck? And you guys seen the truck? Who's messing with me? Who took the truck and everything? And I don't know how, but he ends up coming into my office and says, you know, where's the truck? And I start saying, what are you talking about? What truck? What do you, you know, I went up to get the mail. And, you know, Rodney, you can kind of describe what you were thinking at that point in time.
I went to get the mail. I come out, cushion is gone. So I'm like, okay, one of these guys playing a practical joke. I'll go back downstairs. It'll be down there somewhere. I go back downstairs. I don't see it. So I let a little time go by because I said, well, I'm going to have to tell Paul that somebody stole the cushion. So I got Pee-wee driving me around to the football stadium because they had just built the football stadium then. And I got him riding me around to see if somebody had taken it over to the football stadium. Meanwhile, he knows what's going on the whole time. He doesn't say anything. He just rides me around. Finally, I go and I tell Paul, I said, I think somebody stole the cushion. What are we going to do now?
So
this was 9 in the morning, I think.
Yeah. And you had to leave early that day. You had to leave at like
right,
noon
I had
or
a
1
doctor's
o'clock.
Appointment. I was having back issues. So George tells me to come upstairs.
Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. There's a couple of instances between all this. And as Pee-wee's taking him around the stadium, they're driving all over the complex looking for this truck. And we keep moving the truck to different hiding places where we know they've already been.
Yeah, because I was checking.
And this story, and this is not at all pre-planned. We're making this up as we go along. So this is just getting bigger and bigger. And we start pulling in other people. So I knew when he comes back, I was going to tell Rodney, well, Rodney, you know, we're going to have to make a report to the security office. So I go down and I talk to Slusher down there, Jim Slusher, who was the head of security for the Maryland Stadium Authority. And I said, Jim, I said, we're pulling this practical joke on this guy. So just play right along with us when we call you. So Rodney gets back and I said, Rodney, and Rodney tells me about what's going on. I said, oh, this is not good, Rodney. You know, you might have to pay for this thing if we can't find this thing. We're going to have to call security. And Rodney, at this point in time, still thinks somebody's messing with him. You know, he's not convinced that something actually happened. He thinks somebody's messing with him. So I go, we're going to have to bring security down here and take a report, and then I'm going to have to talk to Joe Foss, the Orioles COO, about this whole thing. And I had already called Joe Foss to let him in on the whole joke. So we get security down there. They're taking a report. And I don't know, at what point, Rodney, did you start think, okay, this is real? Something's happening.
When Joe Foss came down there.
When Joe Foss came down, yeah. Foss comes down to my office.
When he got involved, I said, uh-oh. I said, I done messed up now. This is for real.
You know, we're starting to talk about, well, this is going to have to come out of your paycheck, Rodney. You know, this truck is a $20,000 vehicle. We just can't be soaking this up. And so so eventually we're trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to end this joke? How are we going to end this thing? And so Rodney had gone off somewhere again to do something. I forget what. And I'm talking to George, one of the guys on the crew. And George goes, I know, I'll go down to the cleaning group and pay a guy $5 to drive the truck past Rodney. So he goes down, he gets that all worked out, and we start setting up how we're going to finish up this thing. So here's what happened. So George was going to take Rodney and take him upstairs, up into the main level of the ballpark, just on the outside. And Pee-wee was going to take the truck with this guy that we paid off to drive the truck, and we were going to stage him in another location. Ronnie, who was my other assistant, and myself, we went up on the top of the ballpark. Ronnie's got a radio. Pee-wee's got a radio in the truck, and we're going to signal him when to drive by Rodney. Meanwhile, I've got a camera up there. I'm snapping pictures of this whole thing taking place. So here we see we're standing up in the upper deck looking down, and here comes George walking with Rodney out of the ballpark. And and I get on the radio, and I go, okay, I said, okay, Pee-wee, go ahead and start driving by. And so you see George and Rodney walking along there, and all of a sudden the truck goes driving by Rodney, and not at a fast speed. It's just fast enough so you got to run to get it. And Rodney does
right,
a
and I had on a back brace. So
yeah, I
need
a back brace now, so he was not in good shape. So Rodney does this double take, and then he goes, hey, that's our truck. And he starts.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm chasing behind this truck. I never seen this guy before that's driving the truck. So I'm running behind the truck. Hey, give us our truck back. Hey. Next thing I know, Pee-wee come out of the back of the truck like some squat man or something and took my picture, and then I stopped running and said, oh, they got And then Paul and Ronnie say, look up here. And I turned around, and they were taking my pictures on the top of the roof.
We're up on the top of the upper deck snapping pictures of Rodney chasing after the truck.
I have been in so many good practical jokes. That one was definitely on me.
Yeah. Well, that was
nothing but laugh.
And normally you couldn't get Rodney on a practical joke. It, you know, but this one got him. It was
They got me good, and it worked all day. It started at 8 and it didn't stop until 1 o'clock when I was leaving.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
so this went all day.
Yeah, we had nothing else to do. It pretty much ate the whole day up.
It was a good one, though.
What do you guys remember about the All-Star game in 93?
I remember the All-Star game in 93 for me was kind of a pain in the neck, but the day before it was awesome.
I remember that.
You had all the Hollywood people came out onto the field and did their, like, they had like a little miniature game or something. I remember Tom Selleck being there and Bill Murray and Michael Jordan was there.
Yeah, and then they had the softball game.
Yeah, they had the softball game. Then they had the home run hitting contest.
Right. Which at that time was done in the daytime. It wasn't done at night live.
Yeah, it was daytime. And a lot less, I mean, they basically just, you know, how it's like super overproduced nowadays. I'm kind of glad we had it when we did, because I mean the guy just came out on the field and just started whacking baseballs all over the place, and saw some really amazing stuff happen during that whole contest.
But, I just remember people being all over the field, everywhere, and thinking to myself, they tearing the field apart.
Yeah,
because they were everywhere.
And this was the other occasion where I about had a nervous breakdown. We had had 10 days of 100-degree temperatures, 10 consistent days of temperatures of above 100 degrees. Nighttime lows weren't getting below 80.
And you guys are on bluegrass.
And we're on bluegrass, yeah. And suddenly, we've got, it was the worst summer patch season in the history of Maryland at that time. And we had been spraying preventatively for it. But even with the amount of stress that was being put on that turf, we had summer patch running rampant throughout that field. I would say probably about on the order of about 5 to 7% of the turf, which doesn't sound like a lot, but on a major league field, it's a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And there was no ryegrass. It was a straight bluegrass field, no ryegrass to cover it up and no time to fix it. And the field looked like crap. And I remember that day before that Rob was talking about with all his events that went from 9 in the morning till 5 that night with no break for us to go in there and cool the turf down or anything. And I didn't come out of my office. I think Rodney and all those guys did all the work. I didn't want to drag the fields. I was sick to my stomach. And I remember calling the concessionaire at the end of the day because, you know, they had all these people crammed into our little tiny foul territory. They were just destroying the turf. And I called our concessions group and I said, I need all the leftover ice that you guys have in the ballpark. And we went around with the truck and we collected all the ice they had. And at the end of the event, as people were clearing out, we're down there behind home plate in the foul territory, spreading ice all over the place and then pouring water on it to cool down the root zone.
Good idea.
And actually, it really made the grass turgid again and stand back up. But we would lose a majority of that turf within 2 or 3 days.
We had to replace it. After the All-Star game.
Yeah. We actually had a 2-week homestand right after the All-Star game, and we didn't have time to strip it and sod it. So we lived through that 2-week homestand with ugly, ugly brown turf behind home plate. And then in the middle of that whole event, we had one of our two famous times that we got stuck and we couldn't get the tarp on the field. And the rain poured down on it, and then amazingly, a bunch of the turf came back from that, but not all of it.
Wow.
We still had to sod a bunch of it. So the All-Star game is not that great a deal to have. And if you can talk, as you know, Teresa, Larry had it last year for Rob and Rodney. You guys don't know this, but Teresa's married to Larry DeVito, who's the head groundskeeper for the Twins, and they had it last year. And it is not a fun event.
It's worse. It's worse than it used to be. They've Hollywooded it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's stressful on us.
And you don't get any bonus for all the extra hours. Yeah,
right.
It's awful.
Yeah, it's just us.
It's not like the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other thing I got to ask you guys, do you guys remember the worst rain event that we dealt with in the years I was there?
The worst rain event?
Yeah. I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint. It was a 4-game series.
I think the worst one, I know we got the top beat us down one time. I think the worst one was when we was at Memorial Stadium, I believe it was, when the young kid passed out in the outfield.
You mean the one that you saved?
To me, that was the worst one.
Yeah, he didn't pass out. He had a heart attack on the field. That was
he had a heart attack.
Yeah, so we had a he was either 16 or 17 at the time. That was John Soper, who had a heart attack on the field during we were dumping the tarp to right field, and John was on the corner of the tarp, and I was down the line on that tarp, and as we were dumping it, he went down in full cardiac arrest. And if I recall, we lost him twice on the field. You revived him, and you lost him again, correct, Rodney?
Yeah, we did.
Rodney and Pat Sandron, the head groundskeeper, went right to work on him with CPR. I ran to get the paramedics. And this is in front of all the fans, all the ball players. We were playing Seattle that time. And it was about a 25-minute delay while we had the ambulance right out on the field there. And thankfully, he lived. And this kid was athletic. I mean, he was in good shape. But they later found
he wasn't overweight.
Yeah.
I just remember seeing him down. I didn't even know what was going on. Yeah. And I just ran over there. I didn't even know what was going on until I actually got there. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I just reacted. And it was weird because I had just learned how to do CPR, I think, about, I want to say, a year or two before that. Because I had a child staying with me that was sick, and they were saying that if I ever had, and that's how I learned how to do CPR, and I never would have thought I would have had to use it.
That's amazing. And that you were able to keep your cool when that happened is remarkable. As a lifeguard, I've had several emergencies, and finding someone who can keep their cool during one is very difficult. A lot of people lose their heads when that happens.
Well, when you see your leaders under control, like Paul was under control. Paul knew exactly what to do. Rodney and Pat got him. Y'all good? Yes. Yeah. Paul went and got help. Pat was cool during the whole process. And he had a couple of cousins, I think, was working there.
Yeah.
Rich Soper and his brother also was working there, Joe.
Joe, yep.
And they were all standing around crying. I remember looking at them because they were crying. And I was like, because when we lost him the first time, I was like, oh, boy. And then we just kept working on him, and then we revived him, and then the doctor came.
That almost never
happened. I just remember going home that night not being able to sleep.
Yeah. They found out later afterwards that he had had a heart murmur that was never picked up in any of his physicals before that. So he was actually had a pacemaker implanted in him at that young age. And actually, I just saw on Facebook recently, he just had one replaced. But he's alive and doing well. He couldn't work anymore in the crew after that. But it shows people how stressful moving a tarp around is. We make it look really easy from the seats. It looks easy, but when you go down and actually do it, it is very hard work to do. And a lot of our listeners already know that kind of thing. The rain event I was talking about was we had a 4-game series against Texas.
I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were pulling the tarp. I want to say anywhere between 5 and 8 times a day and multiple times in games on every one of those first 3 days of the homestand. And the last day was a getaway day. It was a Thursday afternoon game. And I remember rolling the tarp up at pregame. It was either at pregame or we had already put it out once in the game again because rain continued. And I remember turning to the umpire and I said, if you call for this again, it may get out there. And if it does get out there, it's not coming back up because my guys are, I mean, we were like rubber band legs.
Yeah, we were exhausted.
You have no idea what it's like when you have to do that many tarp pulls in a 4-day period, high humidity, high heat, a lot of heavy rains. And what do you remember about that, Rob?
The thing I remember about that was by about day 3 or day 4, I had ditched my shoes. because you're out there running around in soaked shoes, with socks on. I had gone through my supply of backup socks. So by day 3 or day 4, when we were in there in the morning just working on the field, I just said, you know what? the hell with it. I'm taking my shoes off, and I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to pull tarp barefoot. And I did that a time or two until, you know, it got too close to the game time, and I put my shoes back on. But, yeah, that was I seem to remember one of those games, and it might have been that Thursday day game, that it was real hot and real humid.
Mm-hmm.
The sun was out. We were behind the tarp waiting for the storm to get here, but the sun was out, and we were just cooking back there because we had the synthetic rubber track at that time.
Ooh.
And you're sitting behind this tarp, which has got this, you know, dark green cover on it, so it blends into the wall.
Yeah.
And I remember Paul, I think, asked me on the radio, "How you guys doing out there?" And I'm like, "Man, when is this rain?" You know, we wanted it to rain at that point because
we wanted
something to fall on us to cool us down. I'm like, "Man, we're dying back here. When is it getting here?" And he's like, "Hang on, it, you know, about 5-10 minutes, and I'll be here."
What?
And I remember it did finally get there in a hurry, and we got it on. But yeah, that was a rough homestand.
We just I have never seen my crew so exhausted, and myself included. I mean, it literally, when you took the tarp out, your legs were like rubber bands. You couldn't stand on them.
Yeah.
You'd get done and your legs would be quivering.
What year did you say that was again? Or did you say?
Do you remember,
was
Rob? I want to say it was around 98.
I went through the same thing in Durham.
Sometime that time.
Yeah, it was sometime around there, because I think we had to keep running out there because they were still in the playoff on the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why we had to just keep.
I lost my voice at the end of the third day. I lost my voice, and WBAL radio interviews me then on Thursday for the pregame show, and I've got no voice, and it's like, why do you wait till I've lost my voice? But I couldn't control my crew because I couldn't yell loud enough in the stadium like I usually, because I have a pretty booming voice, and in the stadium it's pretty easy. But
I remember feeling so wet, exhausted, and
weak.
I think we didn't even sit in the chairs when we came. We all sat along the wall.
Yeah.
When we got down there, we just sat along the wall.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
That was a rough day.
Well, guys, I appreciate you taking the time to relive some of these good and bad memories.
Any last juicy bits about Paul before we go?
Okay, yeah, go ahead and spell it.
Say it again.
Any last juicy things we need to know about Paul before we go? Like, were you guys really glad that he lost his voice during that time period?
No, I wasn't, because Paul had became, like, my best friend at that point.
Aw.
So everybody thought Paul was hard. I thought Paul was good. Because, see, I always wanted to be better than everybody on the full-time crew. That was my goal.
Hmm.
Now, Pat didn't stay there long enough for me to catch him. Unfortunately, I didn't catch Paul, but I got everybody else. I didn't get Paul, but I got everybody else. But Paul helped me. He sort of groomed me into the man I am today, because I always loved to work hard. But Paul always made sure we were good. When nobody else seemed to care about us, Paul always went to bat for us.
He got us
so many things that I don't even think Pat would have done.
Right,
Paul always went to bat for us. He took care of us. He always made sure that we had what we needed. All he wanted out of us was to give your best and to work hard.
Yeah. The thing about Rodney was, Rodney learned really well. And, you know, I had two assistants. I had Ronnie Potter and I had Rodney. And Ronnie, I could never trust with the infield dirt. He knew his turf stuff, but he didn't know his dirt stuff. And then his line was always, "Oh, that's good enough." and Rodney would say, "No, Paul said a half a truckload of soil, and that's what we're going to give him." But Rodney and I got to the point where we were so close and knew each other so well that Rodney would always know exactly what I was thinking in the later years. And it was just incredible to watch Rodney. When you consider, here's an inner city kid who didn't go to college. Rodney was sharp, and he knew his crap when it came to the infield soils and how to maintain them and how to make them good. He was a sharp kid, and I love Rodney to death, and I still do to this day. And that's the one person I always make sure I see whenever I go back to Baltimore. Sorry, Rob.
Hey, Rob, now's your chance.
Now's your chance, Rob, to really dig on me.
I'm still going to town down here, guys. I don't know what you're doing, but, you know.
So, any last words from you, Rob?
Well, I just, on the topic of you, I would have to say probably that you are one of the best managers of people I think I've ever been around. And I'm not just talking about in working down there at the ballpark. Obviously this is a seasonal job for me. So I've worked retail, I've worked food service, I've worked supermarkets, I've worked office work. And in all that time, there are very, very few people that I would put up on your level of how you deal with people and how you organize, a staff and a work day and just the whole thing. Organizationally, you were, I think, the best I've ever worked for.
Yeah, I second that.
That's really cool, guys. I was kind of hoping for some juicy dirt on Paul, but that was even better.
Well, I know what his middle name is, but I'm not going to say it on here because I know he's that's kind of a touchy subject.
All right. Well, if you guys are done reminiscing, we could do this for probably about 12 hours.
Easily.
But unfortunately, we don't have that kind of time, unfortunately, and we don't have some of our other coworkers to get on and pick on here. but I really appreciate you guys taking the time out of your day to join us today, and hopefully you enjoyed it. And there is good news, guys. I'm looking to come out right around the 4th of July this year, so I hope to see both of you as usual.
Okay.
You know, Rodney, I always pop in where you work all the time anyway. So
yeah,
I know
that's where I'm
work.
At right now.
Well, you better get back to work then.
Yeah, I will.
All right,
guys. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. All right. Thanks for having us on.
You bet. Well, the rains continue to pound many parts of the U.S. recently, and Beacon Puddle Sponges are flying off the shelves here at Beacon Athletics. They're a quick, easy, and cost-effective way to remove standing water from an infield. No infield material is disturbed or relocated when using this product. The sponges are 20 inches by 15 inches and 3 inches thick. They come 3 to a set. They're instantly reusable. Simply go to your puddle, soak up the water into the sponge, and walk off to a grassy surface and wring it out. The puddle sponge is immediately ready to soak up more water. Save the drying agent until after you've removed all the standing water off of your infield skin. These sponges have a long life, and the cover is removable in case you need to wash any fine clay and silt particles out of the fabric. They also have a convenient hanging loop, so if you need to dry it out, you can simply hang it on a fence and let it air dry and let the water drain out. Hide the brooms and hang these in the dugouts for the coaches and volunteers to use. Get your Beacon Puddle Sponges by going to the Beacon Web Store at www.beaconathletics.com or call our experienced sales staff at 800-747-5985. Suck it up. Don't sweep it out. Is your field Beacon Puddle Sponge worthy? Well, I tell you, Teresa, that was really special to be able to talk to those guys. You know, I like I said during the interview, we were a family. You know, you're forced together, you live together. You know, we're working 16-hour days, 10, 15 days at a time. And, you know, the guys who are out in the industry now, they understand that because and I think it's even
at
worse.
At any level.
And I think it's worse now than it was back when I was in those days, especially at the major league level, because there's so many more events. There's so much more time spent at the park as it was before. And, you know, you become a team. And, you know, that's interesting because my son played hockey in high school and beyond. He went into playing juniors. And we were having a conversation one day, and he said something like, you know, Dad, you don't understand what it's like. You've never been on an organized team. And I said, oh, yes, I have. I said, I was on a team for 15 years. And I said, and I'm not talking about dealing with the ball players. I'm talking about my crew. We were a team. We were very tight. We worked together just like your sports teams are. And you know, being the typical teenager, it's like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, you know, 2 years later, a year or two later, actually, I brought him with me out to Baltimore on one of my trips. And whenever I go out to Baltimore, I have a big reunion with whoever we can get together from the crew. And he sat around there that night after the game and heard all the stories, heard about all the things that we went through together and he would talk to some of these guys individually, and he heard stories about them dealing with me and all that kind of stuff. And he started to get the picture that, yes, we were as tight as his hockey teams were. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the night, as we were leaving, we're driving away, heading back to the hotel, he said, you know, you were right. You were on a team before, and I understand now what it's like and why, you know, why you can identify with what I went through and some of my hockey stuff. And I said, yeah, well, that's, you know, that's how tight you get when you work in a common goal and you work long hours and you're away from your family. And this is your only other family.
Yeah. And it's so much like family because, you know, we don't always get to choose who we're on our cruise with, but we have to find a way to not just get along, but even more than that, to form these deep relationships because we have to rely on each other so much.
And you have to care. You have to care about what they're going through in their lives. And I did that. You know, there was several people on my crew that I let go of that I bought back a year or so later. And they would turn around. They would make the turnaround and they would do better. And I was one of those people who gave people a lot of chances. And more often than not, if not every time, they turned around. And you know, that's really what the big reward is for a manager in the long haul is what you hear from these kids years later. You know, that's the part I love doing now when I go back and see how these guys have turned out, their families, their kids, and they say to you, you know, I never understood you when you were in charge of us. You know, you would have us do stuff and I would like, you know, why are we doing this kind of stuff? But now, you know, now I understand it and thank you. And, you know, you get a lot of thank yous from guys who were just teenagers when they were working for you. Mm-hmm. And who didn't quite get it. And, you know, it's the same revelation that you have growing up. You know, you get into the teens and 20s and you think you know everything more than your parents. But then you get into the 30s and 40s of having a family and you start to understand why your dad was the way he was or your mom was the way she was and why they managed the kids that way. And eventually you say to your parents, hey, you know, thanks for being great role models or whatever. And that kind of stuff. It's much the same way. And, to me, that is the ultimate reward of doing what I do and or what I did back then. And, you know, even the guys who gave me the biggest trouble back then, I still love them to death today. And they're completely different people because they learned from that situation. So a great reward. And with that, the only other thing I want to say is, you know, we haven't talked about how you and I met.
We got carried away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I just remember I when I switched over to turf from pre-med and gave my dad a heart attack. he
probably thought savings.
Yeah, well, that too. A friend of the family who is now my, this sounds so wrong, is now my stepfather, but it didn't work out that way for any other reason. We've just known him all my life. He runs a landscaping company out of Roanoke, Virginia. And
and the name of the company is?
Landscape Supply Incorporated. Brilliantly
named.
Yeah. Oh, and get a plug. Yeah. Yep. But, you know, they've been around for ages and they every year do their own, and now they do a couple of them, but they do their own conference, a day-long conference where you can go get your CEUs. And they try to get local luminaries, such as Mr. Paul Zawaska, head groundskeeper of the Baltimore Orioles, local luminaries to come in and give talks to the local guys who are trying to learn to do things and get their CEUs and all of that. And so he had Paul in shortly after I had switched majors, and he said, my stepfather, it's very gruff in his voice, and I accidentally do his voice. I don't need to do that. But he said, Teresa, what I'm going to do here is I want you to come to this conference, and then I'm going to let you take Paul Zawaska to the airport so that you can get a chance to get to know him and maybe start to develop a relationship with him that you can, you know, use for networking later. And I said, oh, that's great. And so I'll never forget this. I was talking to you and you said, well, my flight leaves at whatever, let's say 4:00. My flight leaves at 4:00. So we should probably get out of here at around 2:00. And I said, Paul, the Roanoke Airport is 10 minutes.
I remember that conversation. Now you mentioned it.
It's 10 minutes away, and there are 6 gates, three of which they don't usually use. And we can leave at 3:30. You'll still make your flight. It's okay.
I remember that airport because it was like landing on an aircraft carrier because the runway's so short, and it's touchdown, slam on the brakes.
Yep. Yeah.
It was like, it's like landing at Midway in Chicago.
Yeah, the pilots for Air Force One used to come and do touch and goes and still do at the regional airport just because of the way that it's set up. But yeah, I'll never forget that moment. And you're like, oh, well, okay. And I said, but I'll take you whenever you want to go. If you want to go 2 hours early, that's great. And you're like, yeah, I probably should. So we talked a little bit, and you being you, you said, well, you know, give me a call sometime. And we'll see about, you know, you can come down to the field and take a look at everything. And I was just very polite. And I said, well, careful, I might do that. And then I did. And I came up, and, you know, that was where it started. The following summer, I came up and, you know, spent some time with you and got to see everything in action. And what was great was that you brought me in on a game day. So I got to see how things really, really worked. And see just the kind of work that you guys were putting into it. And at that point I had worked for Durham, so I knew what to expect, but I got to see how different it was on the major league level. The following summer was the better one, or late. I can't remember if it was the following summer or later that summer. I learned enough to know that in my backpack that I brought a pair of khakis. So when you said, oh, well, we got to get rolling, we've got this thing to do, I wish I had some more hands today, I said, huh, I got some khakis. And you go, put them on. Let's go. And then we were in the infield. You handed me a float board. And you said, here, you can do this. And I said, well, I think I can. I'll try. And you looked at me and you said, do or do not. There is no try. And I was like, okay, yeah. Star Wars nerd, me too. Oh, my gosh. We're going to be friends for a while.
So. Yeah. Do you remember what year that was?
That would have been 98 or 99.
Yeah, and at that time, you know, women were just starting to break into the industry because, you know, I remember the first STMA that you went to. I want to say there was only like 3 or 4 women there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I knew.
I can name them all.
Yeah.
It was me. It was Heather Nabosny. It was Rachel, now Volkening. It was Nicole, now McFadden. Fadden?
McFadden.
I don't know why I wanted to say McFadden. Sorry?
I'm just trying to think if Nicole was there the first time. I think that was the second year.
That was the second year. That's right. There was
the
just,
first year she wasn't there yet.
Yeah, it was just me, Rachel, Heather, and Abby McNeil.
Yeah.
And I think there were one or two gals. I hate to say gals. That sounds wrong. But there were one or two women from the extension and university side at that point.
Yeah, it was amazing transformation that occurred in those later years of the 90s and the early 2000s of the women exploding into the industry, which I think is fabulous. So
a
lot of them do a great job. So
yeah, now when you build a park, you have to put in 2 locker rooms. You can't.
Oh,
that
was the mistake I made at Oriole Park. Is that and it's the only mistake I will admit to in our facilities for the grounds area. You know, we had total control of how that was built, and I wouldn't change a thing in that. In the way it was done, with the exception of putting a woman's locker room down.
Maybe
in
make
there.
It a little bigger. It's kind of small.
No, not really. Well, you're gauging it to Buchholz's, you know, Taj Mahal in Philadelphia, which is like, you know, his shop is the size of a football field, which is overkill.
Oh, but, it's not overkill. It's nice.
With more toys than he could possibly use.
He uses them all.
Yes, I'm sure he does. But anyway, so yeah, that was it's, and we've been friends and cohorts and mentor and mentee and all that kind of stuff ever since then. So that's how this whole relationship happened. So
goodness, can't believe it's been
that,
so long.
Yeah. With that, I think we have to end this love-in because that's another one in the books, and you know, it's time to roll along and think about the next show.
Yep.
Be sure to tune in next time to the Diamond Dimitris for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is, it's all free because we're giving the store away around here at Beacon.
Oh, my goodness. You can come and find us on our official webpage, which is at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find our show notes, which will include any links or photos. Probably have a couple of photos from this week, some old photos from the day. I'm going to see if I can find some of the ones I took from back when I visited your field. And, you know, you can also learn more about Paul and I, and we'll have some bonus material up there from time to time.
And past shows.
Yep, that's right. All of our past shows are there. Absolutely.
We'd love to hear from you also. You can email Teresa and I at the podcast at beaconathletics.com. There you can send us your questions or comments on our show, or whether they're good or bad, of course. or if you've got some show ideas, go ahead and send them along, too. We'd love to hear them.
Absolutely. And if by chance you are on Twitter, our Twitter handle is at Diamond Da Vinci's. That's at Diamond DAVINCIS. We're active on and off there, and we'll be posting some different things, especially I'll be posting on there when I've been doing some research for an upcoming show.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And that's it.
Yeah.
The loving is over, sadly. We will see you folks next time. And
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Adios.